Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is our second WebEx hearing today, July 30th, 2020. The rules of appellate procedure apply as they do in real court, this being WebEx court. Please remember you each have 15 minutes to make your case statement, and an additional 5 minutes is reserved to appellant counsel for rebuttal if you use that privilege. Also, please remember to indicate who you are speaking on behalf of and your name, of course, before you begin your remarks. I will now call our case A20-0237, John Fleming Jr. versus State of Minnesota. Appellant counsel, when you're ready to proceed, you can address the court.
Yes, thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Zorislav Lederman, and I represent Mr. Fleming. As the court is aware, Mr. Fleming was convicted of possession of a firearm by an ineligible person back in 2007 after the Supreme Court decided State versus Haywood in 2017. Mr. Fleming filed a petition for post-conviction relief to have his sentence and his conviction vacated. The state did not oppose. The district court granted the petition, and then after that, Mr. Fleming filed a post-conviction compensation petition. And after some delays and briefing, the district court decided to deny the petition, and then we appealed. The issue before the court is whether Mr. Fleming procedurally qualifies for compensation under the statutory definitions. The issues are fairly straightforward. It appears the state has abandoned its arguments that were pursued at the district court about the statute being vague. And so the issue that we have to resolve now is whether Mr. Fleming qualifies under the statutory definition of what it means to be exonerated on grounds consistent with innocence. And what we do in order to answer that question is we simply look to the statute and what the statute defines a term. It talks about any evidence of factual innocence. Recently, in a decision that came out by this court in the middle of us briefing this case, the court actually defined what it means, what the term factual innocence means, because that term is not defined in the statute. And the court defined the term similarly to what we were proposing in our briefing as any evidence that shows some fact establishing the absence of the petitioner's guilt.
I understand and what our court held that to mean. My question to you is, until the Haywood decision, binding law in Minnesota was, at least out of our court and the 1977 case out of the Supreme Court, is that a BB gun, in fact, was a firearm. Haywood changed the law. How did Haywood change the facts?
Your Honor, thank you for the question, Your Honor. And this is basically what's really in dispute in this case. Your Honor, Haywood did not change the law in terms of what a firearm is what a firearm is when it comes to BB guns. Haywood actually stated what was the law all along. We don't have any sort of a change in the legal definition. And if we read Haywood carefully, what Haywood says is that a BB gun was never a firearm. It was not a firearm back in 2006, and it wasn't a firearm back when Haywood was decided and when Mr. Haywood was convicted.
Well, I think it's worse than that. Haywood does talk about other cases in which firearm was interpreted under different statutes, but it did talk about decisions from the Supreme Court and our court that in fact held that a BB gun was a firearm. And Haywood talked about the fact that it was clarifying the law. Are you suggesting that clarification is not a change?
Your Honor, what I'm suggesting is that a BB gun was never defined as a firearm under the statute. And what Haywood decided was a confirmation of that fact, that despite these cases where courts have previously ruled on this issue. When the Supreme Court decided Haywood, if we look to that case carefully, the decision is that BB gun did not qualify as a firearm back when Mr. Fleming was convicted, or back when Mr. Habe was convicted. So yes, I don't dispute that there were many cases in Minnesota and many people were convicted for possession of a BB gun under these felon in possession statutes. And that issue had been addressed by the courts. But the bottom line is that Haywood did decide that a BB gun was never a firearm, as that term is defined in the statutes. And so despite these decisions, my reading of Haywood is that the courts were sending innocent people off to prison under the statute when a BB gun was not a firearm. Haywood did not change the law. And in our view, Haywood simply stated what should have been the law, what was the law all along. If we go back to considering the evidence, what is the factual evidence in this case? The factual evidence is that Mr. Fleming ended up getting convicted for possession of an item that was not a firearm. And that's not merely some kind of a procedural or technical issue. That's a factual determination that he possessed an object that was not a firearm for which he was convicted. And so that is the factual evidence that exonerated him. And the statute makes clear, the exoneration statute makes clear that to determine whether a person was exonerated, we have to look at the decision which overturned the conviction. And in our case, there really wasn't much of a decision from Mr. Fleming because he filed a petition and really wasn't objected to and it was reversed. But the basis for the petition and the basis for the reversal was, again, the fact that Mr. Fleming did not possess a firearm. He possessed a BB gun. He could have possessed a stick or a toy gun or a water gun. The analysis would have been the same because he had an item that was not a firearm. He was convicted for it. He went to prison. And when the district court overturned that decision, overturned the conviction, it was based on the fact that Mr. Fleming did not commit a crime. He was innocent back when the offense allegedly happened, and he was innocent when he sought post-conviction relief. Judge Berkman, in response to your question, again, I'll bring up something else. If the law was that back when Mr. Fleming was convicted, that possession of a BB gun was a crime, then why would the district court then reverse his conviction? If it was a crime back in 2006 when he was charged, and if Haywood changed the law to something that it wasn't, then Mr. Fleming's conviction should have remained in place, because if he committed the crime under the old law when a BB gun was a crime, then he was still guilty in 2017 after Haywood came out. So once again, the fact that his conviction was reversed is just more evidence and more support for the fact that he never committed the crime in the first place.
Can I ask you a question about that?
Yes, Judge.
Oh, we have a lot of background noise. Okay.
Just a minute, Judge Smith, before you go. Judge Bjorkman has left the screen. Can you hear us?
Yes, there she is.
Judge Bjorkman, can you hear us? Just want to make sure you can hear us. You're muted, but okay, we'll go ahead.
I just wanted to follow. Can you explain, let's say, posit for a moment that, in fact, Seifert had held that a BB gun was, that the Supreme Court had earlier held a BB gun was a firearm, and then your client is convicted, and then later the Supreme Court overrules, like expressly overrules that decision in Haywood. Are you in that case? Would there be no? Would the earlier conviction not be vacated? Is that what you're saying? That if it were a change in the law, and then by change in law I mean a change in the Supreme Court's interpretation of the law, such that it expressly overruled, what would be the result then relative to the conviction? Are you saying,
Your Honor, in our view, the result would still be the same given what later happened in Haywood.
When you were saying, that if it had changed the law, the district court would not have vacated the conviction. That it still would have vacated it, even if it had changed it in that it expressly overruled its previous interpretation.
Well, Your Honor, what I was saying is that if the law really had changed, that means that under the law in place at the time when the offense was committed, then there was a criminal act, there was a criminal violation. And so why would we reverse a criminal conviction if at the time of the crime, the alleged crime was committed, that it was a crime? It's the same thing as if the statutes change. If we have a statute, if the BB gun actually was defined in the statute as being a firearm back in 2006 when Mr. Fleming committed the offense. And let's say in 2017, rather than Haywood, we have the legislature comes in and says, we're going to change that. And now a BB gun is no longer a firearm. And if Mr. Fleming tried to file a petition for post-conviction relief, that would have been denied at that point, because under the old statute, he committed the crime still. The statute changed.
Right. I of course understand that relative to a statute changing. I'm just trying to understand the argument with respect to a Supreme Court in Haywood. I'm just trying to understand if there's a difference between clarifying the statute in Haywood's and saying the statute always meant X. We're clarifying to the extent there was any confusion,
right,
or the Supreme Court actually reversing an earlier decision. If we were to posit that it actually, overruled an earlier decision, does that matter to your argument? Or would you still say, well, once they overruled it, they're saying, no, the statute never meant that, we were just simply wrong. Does it matter to your argument whether it's an overruling or a clarification, is what I'm trying to understand.
Sure, Your Honor, I get the question now, and yes, I think it would make a difference if it overruled it, but again, if the Supreme Court was overruling prior decisions, then that still brings us back to the question of, well, should Mr. Fleming's conviction have been overturned then? Because if they're changing the law, then we have two different sets of laws that apply at two different periods of time. And I think, yes.
I.e. whether it's a constitutional infirmity that's always been there with the statute versus the public policy has changed.
Your Honor, I apologize. There was some breakup, and I couldn't hear part of your question.
And I'm getting a lot of feedback. I don't know why. And I apologize for that. What I was asking is whether it matters why a decision was overturned, whether it was on, for example, constitutional grounds versus some other change in the public policy.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor, I believe that does matter. And if the court looks at the Buell case, I think that's a case from a couple of years ago. This court in Buell did talk about the distinction between a factual exoneration versus more of a procedural one. The court talked about introduction of improper Spriegel evidence, issues dealing with Fourth Amendment search and seizure if somebody's convicted based on evidence that was illegally seized. Those kinds of issues do not warrant compensation. But issues regarding guilt versus innocence, and this is the language that's used in Buell, if the reversal pertains to guilt or innocence of the defendant or the petitioner in the post-conviction case, then at that point, that is a factual determination that does allow the person to at least have a hearing on the issue of compensation. I do want to talk quickly about the Livingston case. It's an unpublished decision, but I still think it matters given the lack of case law on the statute. And in our view, this Livingston case is on all fours with what's happening here. We have this diphenhydramine, I believe is the way to pronounce it. I'm not sure how to say it properly, but this chemical, which was an issue in that case, it's a very similar issue to what we have here. It was a term. It was a substance that wasn't defined in the statutory language. Everyone previously thought that it was a hazardous substance, so you can be convicted for DWI. Then the Supreme Court comes in and says, no, this is not a hazardous substance. And this court determined that the petitioner in that case in Livingston should have been eligible for compensation given what the state in our case now refers to as a change in the law. So it's a different statute, it's different language, but the underlying issues are identical to what's happening in our case, because it's something that the courts believe was a crime. Then the Supreme Court said, no, it was never a crime.
Was there binding precedent before or at the time of Livingston's case that said, yes, the substance is a controlled substance that you can't inject.
Your Honor, I will admit that the case law on this substance in the Carson case was not as developed as the BB gun issue in our case. People have been challenging these BB gun cases for years, and there were numerous decisions, and I realize that, but still, the reasoning in Livingston is essentially the same as the reasoning here. That substance in Carson was never a hazardous substance, even though people thought that it may have been. The person in Livingston actually pled guilty and then decided to pull the plea. The reasoning and the analysis is all the same. And then the final thing I'll say is Mr. Fleming was innocent. He was innocent back when he committed this crime. He's innocent now. And I think what the statute speak to is guilt versus innocence. And what we're trying to figure out is now we know that he was innocent. Why should we deny the petition? I'm out of time, so I'll stop now. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. There was great echo. You're muted yet.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Alexandra Meyer, and I represent Respondent State of Minnesota. In this court's decision on Mr. Fleming's direct appeal in 2009, this court found that Mr. Fleming's conviction was supported by substantial evidence and the law. That substantial evidence has not changed. What has changed is the law. I have two major points I want to focus on today. And the first is that Mr. Fleming's case is distinguishable from the Livingston decision. And secondly, that if you are to follow appellant's analysis, you would be rendering the word factual in the revised exoneration compensation statute superfluous. So first, as to Livingston, published decisions from this court are binding precedent. The law after the Seifert case and the Newman case in 95 was that a BB gun was a firearm. In his reply brief, appellant argues that Haywood did not change the law but stated what it had been all along. This is incorrect. After 2016, a BB gun is no longer a firearm. But in 2006,
and Haywood, as I recall from reading it, didn't the court basically, I mean, it didn't overrule Seifert, did it? It said, essentially, Court of Appeals, we understand why you thought that about Seifert, but you were wrong. That was dictum, and you were wrong. And in fact, it's not a firearm because Seifert involved a guilty plea that had, you know, alternative bases. It could have been a dangerous weapon as well as a firearm, et cetera. So did it change the law, or wasn't Haywood saying, Court of Appeals, you misunderstood what we meant in Seifert? And in fact, it's never been a firearm.
It's correct that they did say that. However, they also said in Haywood that that they understood the court's decision because of the lack of other authority. So if in 1970s, Seifert came out and said a BB gun is a firearm, and then in the legislature changed the definition of the stat or changed the statutes, but did not redefine firearm, that then makes a difference. It means that implicitly, that definition was included in the new version of the statute because we presume the legislature is aware of the decisions of this court. Does that answer your question?
No, I might have gotten lost there. Haywood decided it's not and never was a firearm, and that Seifert was misunderstood, as I read it. The Court of Appeals misunderstood that. And so your argument about the legislature continuing to act by adopting then the Court of Appeals misunderstanding, then why would Haywood be decided the way it was if the legislature adopted the Court of Appeals misunderstanding? I might have missed your argument there.
Well, I think you understood it. It's the way that the Haywood decision was written complicates matters because it does say that what this court relied on was dicta. However, what this court said in its previous decisions was case law, was law until it was changed. So because there are two published cases before this case was decided, before the direct appeal, I think that makes a difference. I think that means there was law that Haywood is overturning, even if Haywood is not describing it that way. I think the courts before Haywood had to rely on the published decisions that existed, and that those decisions did say that a BB gun was a firearm.
If that is true, then why was Mr. Fleming entitled to have his conviction revoked?
So I would direct the court back to the initial petition by appellant at the district court asking to vacate his conviction. And in that, he points out that Haywood narrowed the scope of the felon in possession statute, and therefore the rule retroactively applies. And that's something that the district court agreed with. So because of the way that Haywood narrowed the definition, it is the type of decision that applies retroactively. However, that doesn't mean that at the time the facts of the conviction or the facts of the case have changed. So by appellant's own logic at the district court, Haywood changed something, which because it was a substantial change in the law, the district court should apply retroactively, which the state agreed for various reasons.
So what I'm trying to figure out do you think Livingston, I know it's unpublished, do you think it was wrongly decided?
No, I think Livingston is very specific and tailored to one individual definition in the law. I think in that situation, DFE was never, ever a hazardous substance, so that Livingston was on notice.
So was it a hazardous substance? So in your view then, I mean, there was an opinion that I'm familiar with. What was it called, Carson? I don't recall. Judge Working and I are familiar with it, that held for a time by the Court of Appeals that it was this dust off, whatever that's the trade name or brand name of it, that was an intoxicant. That got reversed by the Supreme Court. In the meantime, there was a moment, a period of time, assuming that was published, and I actually can't recall right now, but let's assume it was a published decision, yeah, that was, quote, the law, at least as far as the Court of Appeals saw it. So as far as anyone, does it matter for the people who, I don't really understand the difference between that. I know that, and what the argument is about the Supreme Court, there are two decisions, Seifert and Haywood, but for a period of time, there was law at the Court of Appeals that it was an intoxicant. What does that mean for people who were convicted at that time? Is it just a timing thing relative to the Court of Appeals misunderstanding of the law?
That would actually be my answer, Your Honor. I believe that Carson was decided while Livingston was still pending. I believe they were closer in time. Here we have 10 years of developed case law between the time that Mr. Haywood possessed a BB gun and the time that the court said a BB gun is no longer a firearm.
And if we just step back for a second, what are we assuming that, I mean, I know that people are assumed to know the law, presumed to know the law. And to me, that sort of means presumed to. Are they presumed to know the ins and outs of what the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court are doing relative to interpretations of that law? That seems a little bit like when we just step back and think this is meant to exonerate, or excuse me, to compensate people who were wrongly imprisoned because what they did turns out was not criminal. It just seems a little odd, the idea that they would, that depends on whether they're keeping up on or reading what the Court of Appeals thinks at a given moment, and that happens to be when they decide to use the substance and drive or carry the BB gun.
I think that's accurate, but the distinction here is that someone needs to be factually innocent, and what you are suggesting is legal innocence, somebody who does not understand the current state of the law and what is or is not a crime, and they are presumed to know what is and is not criminal, but that distinction has nothing to do with the exoneration compensation statute, which you recently found requires factual innocence, and that's not what happened here. The law changed, the facts did not change.
So we had a situation where someone else came forward and said, that was not Mr. Fleming in that car with that BB gun, in fact, it was me. That would be the sort of, under your argument, factual innocence that would support application of exoneration.
Absolutely. If it turned out to be a water pistol, if it was his twin brother that had it, if an officer was found to have lied about the whole arrest incident, all of those are reasons that he would be factually innocent, and that would entitle him to exoneration compensation. That's similar to the decision.
But the statute permits that there be evidence of factual innocence even at the time. It doesn't need to be later discovered. And if the facts are, the facts are, I do not possess a firearm. That's the fact. I do not anywhere on my person have a firearm. Is that not a fact that turns out to be existing at the time? He doesn't have a firearm, and therefore it constitutes factual innocence.
I would have to disagree, because the fact is he possesses a Walther PPK/S weapon. What that is a legal analysis. Is that a firearm? Is that not a firearm? And if you look at what this court was looking at in Freeman, they looked at the definition of what a fact is and looked specifically at the Black's Law definition and said, an actual or alleged event or circumstance as distinguished from its legal effect, consequence, or interpretation. And I think that is the distinction. What he held in his hand in 2006 factually did not change. It has always been this specific item that could have been shown to a jury, was brought in, has a physical weight and substance. Now, what category that falls into, that is a legal distinction, not a factual determination. My second argument would be that if you go with the appellant's argument, then he's asking that you write out the word factual from the definition in the revised statute. So in Livingston, this court held that, I think I already said that.
Well, what if, counsel, what if what had happened is that someone gets convicted and they were holding a water pistol or something else that's not even a BB gun that looks like a pistol, it was a toy or whatever. They get convicted on that. And then later that conviction gets vacated. And in fact, so factually, what they held categorically was not a firearm. It wasn't a BB gun, but nor was it a firearm. No change, no recently developed facts or anything. Is that person exonerated?
That person is exonerated because in 2006, what they held was not a BB gun, which was a firearm at the time. It was something entirely different and should never have been.
We get back to just the case law. It just all has to do with what the case law is saying at that time.
I believe so, Your Honor. I would ask that this court rely more on the published decision in Freeman, where you talked about any evidence of factual innocence, meaning evidence that shows some facts establishing the absence of petitioner's guilt. In 2006, there was no evidence that established the absence of guilt, and that has not changed. Only the legal analysis has changed. There's no fact that has changed. Appellant talked about the Buell case. I would argue that this is more like what was going on in Buell, where evidence was suppressed and then the state could no longer go forward with with charging a crime or convicting somebody of it. The same thing here, the law changed. So if we tried to recharge this case today, we could not do it. That doesn't mean the facts in 2006 changed. I would ask that you apply the plain meaning of factual innocence relied upon in Freeman, that you find that this case is distinguishable from Livingston, and find there's no evidence of factual innocence. If there's no further questions, I'll just ask that you affirm the district court.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Mr. Lederman, you're going to have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honors. Your Honors, if we, I think we're with this whole issue about changing the law versus changing the facts, I think we're losing sight, number one, of what the statute says, And number two, we're losing sight of the whole purpose of what the statute was intended to accomplish. The statute doesn't distinguish between a change in the law and a change in the facts. And in fact, the statute assumes that whatever the factual, whatever evidence of factual innocence is, that even if it was available at the time of trial, that doesn't change the outcome. You can use new evidence or old evidence to establish innocence. And so counsel talked today about the law changed, but the facts didn't change. The statute doesn't require that the facts change. The statute allows for the same facts to be in place. What the statute was intended to do was to provide compensation for people who went to prison and spent time in prison for a crime that they did not commit, or if they went to prison for something that wasn't a crime. And that's exactly what we have going on in this case. Mr. Fleming ended up going to prison even though he did not commit a crime. And that, you know, we can spin this in many different ways, but the bottom line is per Haywood, and we can, you know, agree or disagree of whether that decision was right or wrong, but the bottom line is per Haywood, Mr. Fleming is innocent. He did not commit a crime, and that's exactly why his conviction was overturned. And so now we're at a point where, well, is he entitled to compensation he spent almost 10 years in prison on this case. And so the question is, does he get compensation for that? And what the state wants to do is say no, because the law changed, but the facts didn't change. And I would ask the court to just go back and look to the language of the statute rather than deciding whether there was a change in the law or a change in the facts. The question under the statute is, was his conviction overturned based on some factor of factual innocence? And the answer to that question, even if we were to assume that Hay would change the law, even if we were to give the state that, the bottom line is that no matter how we frame it, he was still had his conviction overturned due to factual innocence. It wasn't because some kind of a procedural violation. It wasn't because he was convicted based on evidence that should have been suppressed. It wasn't because of ineffective assistance of counsel, Spriegel evidence, insufficiency of evidence. His conviction was vacant.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
I'll keep talking. When we first start talking, it has some feedback for some reason. So I apologize for that. And there might be another barrier to this. I'm not familiar enough with the ins and outs of all of the ins and outs of the statute. But let's say that or it's a blank slate. Your client is convicted because has a BB gun, is incarcerated through the appeal, and on appeal that conviction is reversed because the court decides no, BB gun's not a firearm. That period of incarceration, is that compensable then? Is that compensable?
Yes, because the bottom line is still that he was convicted for something that was not a crime.
So even in the actual case on appeal, I mean, what convictions? Well, there might be, of course, many things, a Spriegel, et cetera, new trials. But if it's, it seems like that would broaden substantially the exoneration compensation to even reversals on appeal in a given case.
Your Honor, I don't think so. And again, we're stuck with what the statute says. And so we may disagree about who should or shouldn't be eligible, but the bottom line is the statute says what it says. And if somebody is convicted for something that is not a crime, for a fact that's not a crime, again, not a procedural violation and it's a reversal, but if somebody goes to prison and it turns out that they actually did not commit a crime, that is exactly what the statute was intended to compensate. Is all sorts of circumstances. So yes, whether it's a direct appeal and somebody just spends 9 months in prison while the appeal is pending, or years as Mr. Fleming, if the facts of the case are the person was convicted for an act that does not constitute a crime, that is factual innocence, and there is no way to qualify that as anything else. And in your example, Your Honor, that would warrant compensation. Just so Mr. Fleming's, I would ask the court to reverse. And to order the district court to hold an evidentiary hearing. Thank you.
Thank you.
I've had terrible feedback. The matters are very interesting, well-argued and well-briefed. A decision will be issued in the statutory timeframe. With that said, we will be adjourned from our live hearings. Judges, I will initiate our communication later. Attorneys, you may leave the meeting.